All right, it's time for us to get started in here. Glad you're here. Thanks for your presence tonight. We're going to be continuing our study here in the book of Deuteronomy, looking at chapter 18. We did not finish chapter 18 last Wednesday, so we get back here and dealing with this prophet, like unto me. And this is not the first time that we've seen this. We've seen this earlier in other sections of Scripture. Looking here, we see very specifically Moses again talking about this future prophet. It is interesting that he says, like unto me. And if you tie in Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10, tells us that no other prophet arose like Moses after this, that saw God face to face or was this close in relationship with God. And so, like unto me, if we look at this, it is not that other prophets came along and some of the aspects other prophets have done, but not like Moses, until we get to the life of Christ. And he says here, he will come along from among your countrymen, your brethren, and you shall listen to him. If you want to write out here, you shall listen to him. Matthew chapter 3, verse 17. Matthew 3, 17. And Matthew 17, verse 5. What happens in Matthew chapter 3 and Matthew chapter 17? Matthew 3, 17 and 17, 5. Anybody, what happens there in those two passages? What's that? God speaks. In Matthew chapter 3, he says, "This is my beloved Son." And then what does he add on to that statement at the Mount of Transfiguration in chapter 17? "Hear ye him," right? And this is what this text tells us. You shall listen to him. And God is kind of putting an exclamation point on that concept there. So this is the one you're going to be listening to. And this is according to all that you shall ask of the Lord in Horeb. And this is, you know, he reminds them what they asked of in Horeb. In verse 17, or 16 rather, he says that God was trying to talk to you, and you were like, "No, we can't listen to God. It's too much for us to listen to God that way." And so Moses kind of intervenes, and he is this intercessory that goes between them. And so again, very well representing Christ. Verse 18, "I'll raise up a prophet." And so we see verses 15 through 18, we had the origin of the prophet, and the origin is God. God will be the origin. The word spoken in his name, again, the authority, and this prophet will come up from their countrymen. "I'll put my words in his mouth." If you want to write out here, John chapter 12, John chapter 12, verses 48 through 50, beside verse 18. John 12, 48 through 50. What does Jesus say there concerning the words that he spoke? John 12, 48 through 50. What does Jesus say? Where does Jesus say the words came from? God. Jesus says very plainly, the message I'm speaking, the message that will judge people in the last day, that Jesus was not the origin of that message, that God himself. And so again, I will raise up a prophet, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak them all that I command him. And so we see that in Christ. "It shall come about, whoever will not listen to my words, which also speak in my name, I myself will require it of him." Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 3, verses 20 through 26, we see this tied into Christ. Acts chapter 3, 20 through 26. Also, John chapter 5, 45 through 47, Christ himself said, "Well, Moses was the one talking about me." He was raising his hand. "Will the real prophet please stand up?" Jesus said, "This was me." So if there's any doubt about who was being spoken of here, Jesus says, "This was me," in John chapter 5, verses 45 through 47. So this is important for us to see this, not only Moses, but the future concept of Christ and the importance and the authority that is there, the word spoken in God's name. In verse 21, "You may say in your heart, how will we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, the thing does not come about or come true, this thing which the Lord has is not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously, and you shall not be afraid of him." This last phrase here, the opposite would be true as well. The opposite would be true as well, or should be true, that if this is the prophet of God and he did speak these things, then you should be afraid of him. You should fear and respect him. No teacher, guys? That's random. Okay, I'll talk to that guy. Anyway, we're studying the same thing. So we're studying the Deuteronomy. So it works out well. But you see the reverse there, and that being true as well. So if he is a prophet of God, then he is authoritative, and you must fear, respect, slash obey those commands. And so that's important for us to recognize those things. And then Christ even says, if you're not going to recognize it for what I'm saying, for the works that I'm doing, recognize the authority that he has. So Christ brings this up on several occasions. So it's important for us to acknowledge that and see that connection there with Christ as we go through Deuteronomy. Looking at chapter 19, cities of refuge, something that we've seen before in studying the book of Numbers. And anybody remember city of refuge? What's going on here with the cities of refuge? What happens here? What's that? Yes, it's like an on-base city, right? So if you accidentally kill somebody, and their family member finds out about it, then that automatically activates this Redeemer guy is going to come out and like reap your soul unless you get to the city first, right? So you have to get to the city. So what we've been talking about, some of these themes in the book of Deuteronomy are coming up again, and you're wondering, why are we covering this? We already covered it in the book of Numbers. Correct, we've covered it in the book of Numbers. And actually, we've covered it early on in this chapter, or in this book, in Numbers, in Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 41 through 48, he talks about cities of refuge there on the east side of the river. So he's already established three cities in the section that they're currently in this area that they weren't originally going to be inhabiting, but that they asked permission to inhabit. So that's already been addressed. What's new here with this information is that he talks about the manslayer and getting to this place. But again, remember, we're talking about provisions once you're in a settled nation construct. And cities of refuge is something you need to do. He says here also, prepare the roads for yourself. So make sure there's signage, or to make sure there's roads getting to these places. It's an easy trek to get. Don't put a city of refuge up on the top of some mountain somewhere that you have to climb 1,000 steps to get to. Make it plain to get to this city. Also, make sure that it's able to get to fairly. So he says, divide three parts of the territory of your land, which the Lord God has given you possession, so the manslayer may not flee, so that any manslayer may flee there. So he's saying, this land you're getting into, divide it into three sections and put a city in each one. Make it fair, again, so he can get to a city, has time to get to a city. I don't know if you were in that time period working construction, which is dangerous, and getting up on a ladder, they specifically mention here, you're swinging an axe and the axe head comes off and kills your friend accidentally. So apparently that was a common thing. So if you're doing that kind of stuff, I would have memorized where this city is. Would you not? Would you want to know where this city is? If you were in construction where you might accidentally kill somebody, you'd want to know where this city is. So you'd have this quick set, you know where the path is to get to these places. So we need to make sure, they said, make sure those things are defined. And it talks about the case of the manslayer. It talks about getting there, because make sure it's not too long, verse 6. And verse 8, there's provisions for a future size enlargement. Early on, when God was talking to them, even in Genesis, about the area that they were going to have, they if everything went well and they were 100% obedient, and 100% operational with God and everything they're doing, and God was blessing them, and they had the courage and were valiant, and every fighter was like, the fighters of David's valiant men, they were going to be able to conquer from the Euphrates down to the Nile. They never got that. God said, this is the possibility. This is how much you could get. But they never got to that grandeur. And so there was a possibility. So he's making provisions here for future enlargements of territory. They did enlarge their borders with David. They did enlarge their borders with Solomon. And so he says, when you enlarge your territory, just like the game of Risk, once you get up to a certain size, you need to add three more cities of refuge on the board, okay? Again, when your borders enlarge, add more cities of refuge. If you play Risk, you know what I'm talking about. Monopoly, maybe some of you do Monopoly. Like, you got to get three houses, four houses to have a hotel. So once you get up to that size, you need to upgrade your cities of refuge. This is important here, and we're going to see this over and over again tonight in this section that we're looking at, in these chapters we're looking at. So why are we doing all these things? Why are we trying to do these things? Why are we, verse 9, carefully observing all that God has commanded us? So innocent blood will not be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you in inheritance, and blood guiltiness will be on you. If you write it here, Proverbs chapter 6, verse 17, what is one thing that God hates? Proverbs chapter 6, verse 17, one thing God hates in connection with shedding innocent blood. What's that?
Shed innocent blood?
Yes, hands that shed innocent blood. And so God hates hands that shed innocent blood. He does not want this to contaminate Israel as a nation. So sin in its various forms is a contamination to the land, a contamination to nation, that's nation as a whole. And so hands that shed innocent blood is a contamination to them. And so in verse, you shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, so that it may be well with you. And so if this person sheds innocent blood or kills somebody in a way that they're not supposed to, and strikes somebody, the avenger of blood must kill him. And so this is the person that lies in wait, that was hating the person before it, and he accidentally killed him, right? Seen those hunting accidents? So if that happens, they're supposed to make sure that person dies, to cleanse that innocent blood from the land. Then we get into another section here, if I'm not putting up on the board here. Landmarks and malicious testimony. Dun, dun, dun. Don't move them. Ancient landmarks, don't move them. You shall not move your neighbor's boundary mark, which the ancestors have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord gives you to possess. Do not move them. If you want to write here, Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 17. There's another passage here that talks about this. Also, Proverbs talks about do not move ancient landmarks. Hosea talks about the sins of the people of the time, that they were like those who moved the boundary marks, and God would pour his vengeance out on them like water. All right, so it's important that you don't move the landmarks. Don't move them. It wouldn't be prudent. Things that are set. Now, that's a metaphor. I like using that metaphor for things that are constant. There are things that God has taught throughout man's tenure here on the planet that have always been true, right? Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, always been true. Husband and wife, always been true. The family unit, always been true. Responsibilities of parents, always been true. These are moral landmarks. You understand what I'm saying? Moral landmarks that God has said, this is where I have taught, and to move them is contrary to what I want. And so, yes, there are people who are moving ancient landmarks, moral landmarks that God has set up, and we're moving those. Once you loose the moral boundaries, guess what? Everything's fair game, right? That's why you have craziness out there, right? You know, people doing all kinds of craziness. We don't have to get into that. You understand what I'm talking about? We can move on. We don't have that kind of time. We get into verse 15 of chapter 19. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. We've seen this before in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 6 and 7. Also, Numbers chapter 35, verse 30 talks about this. So we've seen this before. But why are we talking about this again? Well, we have this extra information here. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, what's a malicious witness? What's that? A liar? A malicious witness? False? Falser? Something to gain by it? Somebody wants to talk to the manager, right? So maybe that's a malicious witness, okay? False information, false witness. You know, there's been tons of evidence of just false accusations made, smearing campaigns, you know. To be Kavanaugh has become like, you know, verbiage nowadays because of the examples that happened there. Yes, sir? Yes, a slander. Slander, this against a name, slander against an individual, and for their own, usually for their own intent. And so if this happens, if this is the case, and God makes provisions here for these people, he says, then both the men who have dispute shall stand before the Lord. Now, is there a case, is it possible that there's a case where something happens and there's only one witness? And there's only one witness. Is that a possibility? That is a possibility. And so the flip side here is also true, and that there's provision made here for if there's only one witness and you are 100% certain that this thing took place, you can go before, if you think you have a rock solid ironclad case, you can go this route. Now what happens if you lose? What happens if you lose? You record it, yes. Get your iPhone out and you record it. No, what happens if you lose in this text? You get the punishment. So you better make sure that you're set. And so, because verse 19 says, the judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he intended to do to his brother. Have you ever heard the phrase, hang him higher than Haman? Hang him higher? Never mind, you probably haven't. So there's, we'll get to that eventually. But there's an individual who was building a gallows for a certain person in the book of Ruth. Esther, I'm sorry, Esther. Mordecai was on the, and Haman. Remember that? Y'all remember the story? And when he was building this gallows, and every time that Mordecai made him mad, he built it higher. And what ended up happening? He ended up getting hung on there. So, yes. So in the old Western shows, they used to say, hang him higher than Haman. Because if you watch, you know, read Louis L'Amour, anybody in here? Okay, never mind. Moving on. All right. So here we have this idea of making sure you understand. And again, thus you shall not show pity. Look at this verse. The rest will hear and be afraid and never again do such an evil thing among you. Have you noticed this? This is something that also repeats. When punishment is dealt, the rest shall hear and they will not repeat the thing. Are we getting the concept of what punishments are for in a society? They are built to instill fear. When you remove the fear of the punishment, you remove the fear of doing the thing. There's a consequence. Yes, exactly. This is a legit thing. This is a legit thing. You will not sit in a cell and get HBO and that kind of stuff. This will be a legit thing. So this is something that's going to happen. Thus you shall show no pity. Here's something that gets taken out of context. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Is this in the concept of vengeance? This is not vengeance. You did this to me, I'm going to do this to you. You hit me in the face and knocked out a tooth, I get to take out one of yours. And people say, well, if we're just going to do vengeance stuff, then we're all going to be blind and toothless and blah, 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 blah. That's not what this is talking about. This is talking about justice. You accused me of doing this thing, and you were going to require this punishment of me for this thing. Well, now it's going to be required of you. This is not about vengeance. This is about justice. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, it's basically saying that if this is what you do, there's an equal consequence to it. So it's equality for
Yes. Yes, so we're talking about equal punishment. Punishment fits the crime. This is not about vengeance. If you take my eye, I'm going to take yours. That's not what this is talking about. This is a not revenge kind of concept. What's that? I'm sorry? Unless you're acquitted, that's right. Yep. So that's important for us to see there. If you want to write out there, Matthew 5:38. This is quoted again in the New Testament. All right, we get into laws of warfare in chapter 20. Laws of warfare. Who shall go to war? And we talk about here in this chapter. When you go out to battle, which they're about to do, so this is pertinent information, do not be afraid. When you go out and you see your horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, when you go out against these people and you see tanks and armaments and things of that nature, do not be afraid. Israel does not have tanks and armaments and accoutrements of that nature. They do not have those things. The people, and when you read in the book of Joshua, they were fighting people that had, this, the text tells us, iron chariots. All right, and they're fighting against those. And they have foot soldiers and phalanx type, you know, fighting against them. But who else do they have on their side? God. If they were all of them valiant and all of them 100% faith type individuals, every one of them was a David. Do you understand what I'm saying? If every one of them was a warrior like David, just send 100. We're good, right? If David's mighty men could kill 800 in a field by themselves, one man by themselves, then send 100 guys up against the city. We'll be good. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if God's with them, who can be against them is this kind of concept, right? Do not be afraid of them. So this is a hoorah kind of like, you know, kind of moment. And he says, then when you go out, your Lord your God brought you up from the land of Egypt. He is with you. Verse 2, when you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people. This is like what we saw in Numbers chapter 31, verse 6, when Phinehas went out with them. Later on, they would call this priest, the anointed of the battle. That's what this priest would be called, the anointed of the battle. And he would kind of be kind of second to the high priest, at least in their traditions. And so the anointed of the battle would be this priest. And he would go out with them. And so he does this, and here he would say, "Hear, O Israel." And you can imagine, you know, if you've seen movies, right? You've seen the movies when they're all lined up in battle array, and you see this person yelling out in front of them and getting them kind of getting up. "Hear, O Israel, you are approaching battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. Do not be afraid. Do not panic. Do not tremble, for the Lord your God is one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." And then we have some addendums here as far as those who don't go out to war. The officers shall speak to their people, saying, "Who is a man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it?" What are they supposed to do? If they haven't dedicated it, that house that they just built, they need to go home. Like if you're a person that's afraid, which there's a clause in here for you as well, but if you're a person that's afraid but doesn't want to say you're afraid, and you know battle's coming soon, you might invest in building a house. Right, you know what I'm saying? You might invest in building a house. "Who is a man who has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use its fruit? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise, he might die in battle and another man would begin to use his fruit." Right out here, Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19, verses 23 through 25. If you planted a vineyard today, in Levitical standards, if you planted a vineyard, and this includes olive trees and fruit-bearing things as well, it would be 5 years before you got to eat anything. 5 years before you got to eat anything. So if there maybe is a war coming up and you're not sure, plant a vineyard. Right? 5 years, because 3 years you're supposed to let it just grow is what God says in Leviticus. The fourth year, everything that's produced is for the Lord. And then the fifth year, you get to eat from it. So that's the season there for that. "And who is a man who has engaged a woman and has not married her? Let him depart to his house, otherwise he might die." Right here also, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 5, that term is extended to a year. If you've married and taken a wife, you're there for 1 year before you can go on your tour of duty with the military. And so what's interesting about these things, also the man who is afraid and faint-hearted, let him depart and return to his house so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart. So if your knees are knocking, there is an out for you as well. So those are the ones that are supposed to be, make sure that they are going out to war. What's interesting is that every one of these kind of addendums here about the vineyard, about the house, and about the family, the household, they all kind of touch on parts of the promise that God has given them, right? The blessings that he was going to give them, houses that they didn't build, vineyards they didn't plant, and this great nation promise, right? And so it's interesting that every one of these things, I want to make sure that those promises are fulfilled to as many as possible. I think is a neat, the text doesn't necessarily say that, but it's interesting that those three are the things that are mentioned here, that continuation. And so the officers are supposed to make sure that happens in that way. In verse 10, when you approach the city, what are they supposed to do when they approach the city? Peace. Offer them peace. Now, this is not, and we'll get to this in a second, this is general warfare. This is not the warfare we're about to engage upon. When you approach a city, fight against it, you shall offer peace. And if they come to the terms of peace, then they are forced labor for you, all right? They're forced labor. That's peace. If they don't make peace and they decide to fight against you, strike them down, and you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that's in the city is all its spoil. You shall take as a spoil for yourself. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you. Verse 15, this is important. That are very far from you, which are not of the cities of the nations nearby, a.k.a. across the river. Because he says in verse 16, only the cities of the people of the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave anything that breathes alive. Scorched earth campaign. That's different. We're talking about in future campaigns, when you enlarge your borders or fight against other peoples, that's fine to seek peace and treaties, but with the people that I'm sending you to, I need them all gone. They're detestable. I need them all gone. They're going in, you're exacting my vengeance upon them, I want them all gone. But the other people, you can take out. And he names them specifically, the people that are on his hit list here, verse 17. Why, verse 18? So that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable deeds. I want you to go in, take this land, purge it, and be a holy nation. And so this is what is supposed to happen. It's interesting, we have some laws here about conservation, beginning of verse 19. When you besiege a city for a long time to make war against it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat of them, and you shall not cut them down. For as a tree of the field of a... he talks about the benefit of these fruit trees. So don't cut down the fruit trees. When you're coming into an area, don't cut down the fruit trees. Oaks, you can cut them down all day long. Oaks, just cut them down. But fruit trees, you can't cut down. So that's just an example here. He says the other trees you can use as ramparts and that kind of stuff, siege works, but not fruit trees. It's interesting also. It says God makes provisions there. It's like, leave those things. You're going to have those. You're going to want to keep those. All right. Chapter 21. I think we're going to make it today, ladies and gentlemen. Innocent blood is shed. A body is found in a field. Dun, dun, dun. Crime Stoppers. What do we do? If a body is found in a field, what do we do? Out in the middle somewhere, they find a corpse. If a slain person is found being in the open country, in the land which the Lord your God gives you, possess it, and it's not known who struck him down, then there's provisions that are made. They get out the measuring tape. All right, you see what they're doing here? The neighboring cities all come together to that place. They find out which city it's closest to, and then those are the people that need to deal with this innocent blood. And so we see there what they're supposed to do with this innocent blood. And we see that there's finding the jurisdiction there, verses 1 through the first part of chapter 3.
And then we make the sacrifice. We have a heifer that comes out. This is a female, young female cow that has never had a yoke, never plowed, never been used for anything. And they go to a place near there in their land that's running water, flowing water, in an area that's never been plowed, never been used, and they break the neck of the heifer. So that sacrifice takes the place of the person that should have died, that killed this person, right? So this is that sacrifice. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him. So they're the ones that come and help make sure that this is settled. And here again, they say in verse 7, you shall answer and say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. So they're supposed to wash their hands over this thing. And forgive our people, whom the Lord your God redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. And the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven. So you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood. Here again, that idea. And he says, when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord, when you do this, like I've told you to do this, then it'll remove the guilt of innocent blood that has been shed. This thing that I hate, that's detestable before me, that's corruption to the land. And so we see this, the influence of sin, even on the land, the influence of sin, even secret sin, sin that, you know, it only affects me, I did this one thing. No, it affects everybody. Let me get into some domestic issues at the end of this chapter. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself. Who are we talking about here? Are we talking about Canaanites and Hivites and all the other ites in the land that they're going to? No, we're not. Again, we're talking about future situation, other scenarios, not in the land that we're talking about. And there may be a possible condition if you tie in, I believe it's Numbers chapter 31, verse 18, when they conquered there on the eastern side and they conquered the peoples. And they kept only the women that had not known a man in that scenario. Maybe that's a possible. It doesn't mention that here specifically. But here's saying, if you see somebody and you desire her, you shall bring her to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. These are things, purification rituals that we've seen and other used in other instances with the Nazarite vow and those kind of things. And so this is similar to what we see in Exodus chapter 21, verse 7. Exodus chapter 21, verse 7, if an Israelite sells his daughter into slavery, she does the very same thing. She does a similar procedure here. And so it's kind of as though this person, this person that you've taken is now becoming and is being adopted into these people and is added into the people and becomes as one of them. And so she's added in this way, brought in this way. And so there's provision made here for her. She mourns for a month, and then just husband and wife. Now, if not pleasing, verse 14, if it shall be, if you're not pleased with her, you shall let her go wherever she wishes, but you shall not certainly sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her in the relationship that you've had with her. So you let her go in that case. All right, verse 15, the right of the firstborn. This first statement, you know, we can doubt the wisdom of it, but if a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be in the day that he wills that what he has to his sons, he cannot make the son he loved of the firstborn woman before the son of the unloved. So you can't switch things around. Let's say, you know, it's hypothetical here. Obviously, this is, I don't know why somebody want to have more than one wife. One is awesome. But if you did that and you had two wives and you had one you liked better than the other, but the one you didn't like as much is the one that bore you the first child, you can't change it. That is, that he will always be the firstborn son, and there's nothing you can do to change it. And God protects there and makes law to make sure it protects those and that right. And so But he shall acknowledge the firstborn son of the unloved by giving him a double portion. Actually, it's literally translated a double mouthful, or a mouth of two, mouthful of two. Yes, ma'am. Time of this ignorance, God winked at. So here in this case, he allowed this to happen. But from the beginning, it was not so, right? That's not what God had intended for them to do. But he allowed them to have two wives. He allowed Abraham. He's not telling them not to, but he is making provisions that if they do, that they are proper as they should be. And that's more than a five-minute answer, by the way. So we can get into that, the right or wrong of that, but that's another class. I'll let Dan teach that. So when we look at this chapter, he says, "For he is the beginning of his strength." This is the firstborn. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. So you cannot take that from him, that double portion. In the last part of this chapter, we have the stubborn child, and if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, and he does not obey his father, it is the parents here that pass judgment. It's the parents here that make the judgment call and take them before the city council, essentially at the gate. And they're the ones that pass this judgment. Proverbs, if you want to write here, Proverbs chapter 19, verse 18. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 18 states, "Discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death." So while there's time, when they're young and moldable, discipline them as much as you possibly, as they need. All right, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I think that fits in here. Proverbs 19:18. Yeah, Proverbs 19:18. Sorry, bro. It's in the Bible. I had to teach it. But in this case, if a disobedient child and his father and mother seize him and bring him out to the elders of the city in the gateway of the town, and they said, "This is a son of ours, stubborn and rebellious, will not obey us, he's a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the city will take him and will stone him. This is harsh. This is like last thing that a parent wants to do. But all the men will do it. They don't require this of the parents to do this thing. But it is also something that they remember. And they seize him and they shall... and they do this thing. In verse 22, "If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and they hung him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but shall surely bury him on the same day." If you write it here, Galatians chapter 3, Galatians chapter 3, verses 13 and 14, talks about this connection with Christ. The curse is a man that hangs on a tree. Galatians 3, 13 through 14. Also, who else was hung? Who else hung themselves? Judas did, right? And so it's interesting there with Judas. When Judas wants to give back the blood money because he shed innocent blood, right? He was the one. They said, "Go take it away, and you do with it what you need. You take care of it yourself," is what they tell him. And so he goes and hangs himself, because he deserved death for what he had done. Maybe he hung himself. There's been a lot of ways he could have died, but maybe he hung himself because he felt cursed in that moment. Thoughts, comments, questions, concerns? All right. Thank you very much for your time tonight. You are dismissed.